Hi everyone. I'm not sure we're starting yet, but I'll just begin. Hey everyone, it's Naomi Wolf here, and welcome. I'm in Yakima, Washington, a beautiful state, beautiful city, surrounded by orchards and fruit trees, and it's an honor to be here. At the same time, I'm also reporting to you in the middle of the zombie apocalypse and the worst crisis of my life to date, which is this massive pandemic and this lockdown. So as I promised, what I'm doing today is I'm going to be reading the first part of a three-part, actually four-part series I gave at Trinity College in Dublin last spring, right after my book Outrages came out. And it explains, and I want you to just bear with me. It's big chunks of very challenging ideas, but it's really important, I think, for us to understand. It's going to explain how technology is erasing history and how technology is shaping the messages and the influencers that we get to hear and understand, so becoming kind of an invisible censor, and how technology is even presenting the histories that big tech companies and big for-profits want to present, as opposed to the kind of histories we used to be able to get in analog spaces, which I'm talking about a lot these days, which we're losing. Physical libraries, physical bookstores can't. Can you hear me? Someone let me know that you can hear me. Town halls, the streets where you could bump into a stranger or strike up a conversation, bars and restaurants where you could gather with other like-minded people. And I am noting that around the world, for reasons that don't make much epidemiological sense, people's private homes, there are new laws keeping people from gathering in, more than one or two people, which of course doesn't make sense if everyone's healthy, everyone's been quarantined, but it is fraying the bonds of human connection. And as I, argue in Outrages, and I'm arguing now, human connection is a very subversive force. It's a radical force. It saves us from tyrants who want to manage our destinies. And it's really in the crosshairs. Like, again, I'm going to say this is a real medical emergency. I wear a mask. I believe in science. But those of you who are following me on this page know that I've been, and on other platforms, I've been disclosing that the data are not verifiable for every single coronavirus website and table that has been presented in Western Europe and North America. And I'm concerned with not verifiable data that human connection is being frayed by policies that kind of go beyond, epidemiological common sense. And it almost seems like human closeness is in the crosshairs. So what I was going to do is read this essay that I wrote and presented in Trinity College. And I'm going to start right now, and it's called The Politics of Memory, How Threats to LGBTQ History, which is how I learned about these assaults on history through technology, threaten everyone. Of course, I wrote about LGBTQ history in Outrages. I wrote about great character in history named John Addington Symonds. So the first section that I'm going to read to you, and then I'll take your questions and comments, is called Bots Assailing Memory and Turf Wars. And I'm going to share that there are some comments about how grateful I am to be awarded the Gold Medal for Philosophy by Trinity College. And I go on to say, as some of you may know, I received the very welcome letter of my nomination for this gold medal while I was in the middle of what seemed like a global controversy. My most recent book, Outrages, Sex, Censorship, and the Criminalization of Love, had been published in Britain on May 20th of this year. and that was last year. It is about the largely forgotten pioneer of the LGBTQ rights movement, the poet and critic John Addington Symonds, who wrote the first gay rights manifesto in English, A Problem in Modern Ethics. He spent his entire life trying to tell the truth about male-male love, about his view that this was not vicious and degraded, but natural and ennobling. At a time when laws made sodomy a capital offense in England, until Symonds was a college student, it was frightening for him to write a love poem to another young man when he was the age of the college students I was speaking to. The death penalty for sodomy was replaced with sentences at hard labor by the time Symonds was a young adult, but he remained terrified of speaking out on behalf of what we would today call gay rights, for good reason. My research followed established work by Dr. H.G. Cox, Dr. Charles Upchurch, and Graham Robb. These scholars had confirmed that decades before this well-known conviction, men convicted of sodomy had been receiving sentences for 5, 10, 15 years, and even lifetime sentences at hard labor for the crime of sodomy. Dr. Cox's work also found, as the parliamentary papers recorded, that 56 men had indeed sadly been executed for sodomy before 1835 in England and Wales. So I knew these facts of LGBTQ plus history, but they are not widely known. While being interviewed by a newspaper in May, I had mentioned that, quote, dozens of men had been executed for sodomy in the 19th century, which is tragically the case. What I said was true. I had also made a mistake in interpreting two later cases. Though a youth and a man had both received death sentences, they had not, in fact, ultimately been executed. So, following an interview that misstated that the dozens of executions in Britain for sodomy I had verbally referenced, quote, did not happen, scores of news outlets repeated this error and thus erased the deaths of dozens of men who had indeed tragically been executed in England in the 19th century for the crime of sodomy. These news outlets were wrong in making these statements, and many of you have probably seen these statements because they were all over everywhere, that I was wrong about these dozens of executions. I wasn't wrong. Not only were dozens of men tragically executed for sodomy in the 19th century in Britain, but a death sentence for sodomy, as Dr. Paul Johnson of York University has shown in his article Buggery in Parliament, 1533 to 2017, in Parliamentary History, would mean a terrifying fear of a sentence that would end in years or even decades at hard labor in Symonds' lifetime. But the misstatements in the media, which involved the erasure of 56 real executions of men for sodomy, and we know that consenting adult men were executed for sodomy, as were sexual predators, child molesters, the offense lumped consenting and unconsenting sex together. This was the premise for a viral tweet release that was quickly amplified by Breitbart in the UK. Suddenly, I was in the middle of a Twitter storm in which about 70 news outlets a day ran this inaccurate story. And the inaccurate story went around the world, whitewashing terrible truths about LGBTQ plus history as it traveled. Some news outlets, such as Agence France-Presse and RawStory.com, most recently Publishers Weekly, ran corrections when I pointed out their wrong reporting. Most others, though, did not. To this day, The Guardian and The New York Times and The Cut have misreported these executions. When you look up my book Outrages, these wrong articles still surface, claiming that these dozens of men were not executed. Newspapers in England and even Ireland editorialized against my book, often restating the mistaken whitewashing of these dozens of deaths. And my Twitter feed was besieged by thousands and thousands of humans and bots, which mostly repeated this inaccurate story, also calling me a Jewish fag hag and other lovely epithets. It turns out there was more than ordinary open debate at play in the digital attacks on my book. The University of Indiana has an open beta project with free tools that can identify the origins of Twitter streams, bots and Twitter streams, their tools found that most of the original retweets of inaccurate attacks whitewashing queer history came from Breitbart-related strongholds and launched from Breitbart UK. The retweets came from Twitter accounts on the far right, including fundamentalist Christian and white supremacist networks, and were mainly from the southeastern United States, in other words, Trump's base. Colleagues in the world of electronic freedom analyzed the human and bot attacks on my book and identified some interesting findings. They found that many of the blogs and tweets identified me as a former Clinton and Gore advisor. That is, the attacks identified me as being on the left. Another finding was that when Google Trends showed my name, and by the way, it's very timely for us to talk about Russian interference in Western debate and outcomes. Another finding was that when Google Trends showed my name and the title of my book trending at 100%, Google Trends also showed a huge spike of activity from Russia related to these search terms. And that is a country where I don't have a publisher, I have never had a book tour, I've never even traveled there, and where my books are not translated. So Russia was lighting up on the map of Google Trends with the terms Naomi Wolf and outrageous. So it is possible that the furore over outrageous last spring, that in the process horrifically whitewashed grave crimes against men whom today we would call gay, that were committed by the British state, you know, dozens of executions that need to be part of history, need to be understood and witnessed, atrocities that represent the fact that the state can make horrible, horrible mistakes, fatal mistakes. It's possible that all of that was purely organic, but it is also possible that a minor scholarly disagreement may also have been amplified and distorted digitally, a capability that those who follow the Cambridge Analytica revelations know is both possible and not uncommon these days. And by the way, since my own digital reputational attack last spring with these, you know, swarms and swarms of bots and human trolls, I've seen this happen to a number of other influencers who are bringing messages that are unwelcome to the powers that be, or who are challenging outcomes for the powers that be. I think that Michael Mann, the climate scientist who wrote The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, was a target of a similar reputational attack. I believe Marianne Williamson has been similarly attacked. She's described being attacked by bots and trolls, repeating things she had never said, which happened to me, happened to Michael Mann. I believe even Megyn Kelly, when she was critical of President Trump, she also described bots and trolls coming at her, assigning to her things she'd never said, you know, creating kind of fatal smears of her reputation. You know, same thing was aimed at Marianne Williamson. And now, you know, I'm seeing even the owner of an independent bookstore being smeared in this way currently. So you can recognize these attacks now, but you need to know that they're happening, and we need to get better at recognizing, because they're very important as we try to engage in democratic debate and understand critical issues like history and like politics. But it's also possible that a minor scholarly disagreement, as I said, may have been amplified in ways that Cambridge Analytica explains. So then the question is, why would that be, right? I mean, this is a book about a dead gay man who was a poet. You know, why would resources be directed at sending bots and trolls on a kind of industrial scale to assail me for things I never said, and to make untrue a set of atrocities in British history that are true. So there might be a number of possible reasons for what may have been a multi-platform digital attack, whose end result is to undo an historical narrative that might position LGBTQ plus rights sympathetically for mainstream voters. One possible reason maybe that we are obviously in an era in which assaults on LGBTQ plus rights are being cynically used by right-wing parties in my country, the United States, in the United Kingdom. I see also now in the Republic of Ireland and in democracies around the world, such as Brazil, to advance the political goals of right-wing parties and politicians. And I am indeed a former political consultant, informally to President Clinton's re-election campaign and formally to the presidential campaign of Al Gore. And as I wrote in the New European, we're in an era in which conservatives in the US, the UK, and other nations all use the same political consultants, right? These are global shops, basically. The same advisors, and on the left and the right, they create think tanks for policy prescriptions that are globally replicated. Sound bites are globally replicated. TV ads are globally replicated. And they align their movements against populations or for the hearts and souls of populations using the same playbooks in country after country. And I promise you, if you've never been a political consultant at these presidential and vice presidential levels, you might not recognize how obvious this is. But please understand, it is happening. It's fully documented. I wrote a piece about it, as I mentioned, the New European that you can look up. And I know what's going to happen in Britain by looking at Australia, which is always the petri dish. I know what's coming to Canada by looking at Britain. I know what they're going to try to do in America by looking at Canada, because they are all advised by the same people on the right. The tactic now involves solidifying a country's conservative base by creating campaigns that position queer people as threats to nationally held values. This tactic also involves splintering voters on the left by creating false divisions. There is a cynical effort in the UK right now in which right-wing US billionaires such as the Koch brothers and Richard Mellon Scaife fund TERFs, TERFs. And I know that the minute this, video goes out, I'm going to get barraged with the vast digital aggression of TERFs, which is largely bot-driven, TERFs, that is cisgendered women and bots who claim to be feminists in order to attack trans women and trans people's rights. Media Matters, the respected US watchdog, has confirmed that the leaders of the TERFs have ties to such right-wing interests in the US as the Heritage Foundation as well. And this pressure from a US-funded, quote, grassroots campaign, as I write, it has resulted in the Boris Johnson government taking aim at the Human Rights Act, which has protected LGBTQ communities since 1998. And I did another video about that here. The effect of that is to weaken LGBTQ communities as voting blocks and to split progressives internally so that, the goal is to make sure that feminists who are, cisgendered women are, quote, at war with trans people, and the T is split from LGB, and everyone is distracted as the Human Rights Act is dismantled in Britain. And you can see this happening at a state level in the US as well as bill after bill takes aim at trans people's rights. So trans people in Ireland and the UK are now being vilified via groups with alliances across the Atlantic. Who are just engaged in splintering opposition blocs before an election. Politics, the manufacturing of queer phobia and transphobia in ways that split a formerly solid front of progressive allies is now no longer local, but global. It's being manufactured at a global level. Okay, so be aware of this. One possibility, a 2019 book that would have revealed to a broader audience than the LGBTQ plus community just how terrifyingly unprotected by the law LGBTQ plus people have been in the past in Britain might have negatively affected the 2020 rollout of this attack on the Human Rights Act, an attack which has been attempted by conservatives since 2014. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say to you. And let's see if there are any questions or comments. Memory is the key. John Wallace says there is an abuse for sure. From what we find out, there is a 98% rate of recovery of COVID. China lied and people died. WHO lied and people died. John Wallace says LGBT rights should be respected. I'm not gay, but I am a psychiatrist. We're in 2020 and tolerance should be part of our society for everyone. Absolutely. Christina La Locadesucia Lundberg II said, it's not only a question of terrible deaths, it's also, and not the least, long-time sickness, which we didn't know before, now coming to light more and more. Okay, L. Casnell said, I respect the perspective of Dr. Wolf, but missed how we got to sodomy from COVID. Okay, so I better explain more. John Wallace says there's lots of bullies out there in the world and they take pleasure in attacking others, and there's a lot of homophobia out there. The cyber bullies are a new generation of people who have issues of their own to start with. Absolutely. Why are the Koch brothers supporting Biden? Asked Sheila Woke Up. I didn't know that they were. That's concerning. I'll find out more about that, or please tell me more. John Wallace said, in the US, there are many people funding radical groups. China is one of these countries which provide funds to take down the US. Sad, though, it's happening in most democracies. John, we're going to get to that in future videos. My husband, who's done a lot of research on China, is a private detective, and he is absolutely persuaded that China is at the forefront of many of the influences right now that are weakening populations in North America and Western Europe. So let me now make the connection between COVID and outrages. It's a thematic connection, not a literal connection. And maybe what I'll do is read the quick next section of this series of essays so you'll see where we're going. Outrages explains. Outrages is the prequel to the end of America, right? And the end of America is where we're at now. So Outrages explains how the state grabbed the role of managing people's bodies and managing their speech as a way to control populations that were newly empowered. Okay, so in that case, the examples that I use are the kind of weaponization of homophobia, the persecution of men for same-sex relationships in the 19th century, but also innovations around censorship of speech in Britain in the 19th century, specifically the Obscene Publications Act of 1857. So this was watched in America. America has the First Amendment. You technically can't censor people. There were no laws against sodomy for most of American history. Certainly no federal laws, but America saw how effective it was for the British state to invent a role in managing people's bodies, using infectious diseases. I've got a chapter on infectious diseases, cholera, typhus, these epidemics that were terrifying, just like COVID is terrifying. And this became an excuse for the state to say, it's our job to manage everyone's relationship to everyone else. It's our job to manage the body. It's our job to insist on vaccinations, even if parents don't want vaccinations. I'm not anti-vax, but that was a big power grab of the state to go inside the physical body. It's our job to say what bodies are okay and what bodies are not okay, as with laws about how trans people can identify in Britain, or laws around abortion. Right? The idea that the state gets to say when you can have an abortion, when you can't, was really invented in the 19th century. The secular state didn't used to have these powers. So the reason I'm talking about outrages as background to where we're at now with COVID, which is a very real medical emergency, is that everyone's so terrified and I would say propagandized to just do whatever the state says. And it's very important to remain critical thinkers right now and to know the history of how the state grabbed these powers in the first place and how the state doesn't always use these powers for the good of the people, even though often things like infectious diseases are used as the reason for the state to grab more and more power. Let me go into the next section, and then you'll see how the threads are coming together, and then we'll save the last two sections for another video. This is called Digital Search is Always Political. And this is how, right now, and I'll use the COVID example, When you post on Twitter, Twitter will block you if what you say about coronavirus is not aligned with certain kind of validated official positions, right? And I'm not weighing in on different points of view. I am really aware that the data about coronavirus doesn't check out. But in a democracy with First Amendment, you should be able to say anything about coronavirus. And we're very endangered because these digital platforms are where most of us get our news, right? So they're being managed when it comes to coronavirus. YouTube is censoring the results you get when, or the kind of circulation that a video will get if it goes against received wisdom about coronavirus and coronavirus policy. Same thing is happening with Facebook. And Mother Jones just did a big expose about how Facebook kind of dialed down the reach of Mother Jones as a, and the effect is to kind of, Mother Jones lost $70,000. I mean, what I'm going to explain in the next section is that we feel like we have all this information because there's streams of knowledge and opinion coming at us from Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, but invisibly, what you can see, what you can talk about, how you can think about things is being managed, all right? And this directly affects history being erased, as well as differing opinions not being made available to you. I mean, many people have had the experience of trying to retweet something controversial, and there is no way to do it, right? I first noticed that happening when I was retweeting atrocities committed by the Israel Defense Forces in Palestine. I couldn't share them. So this is really important for us to grapple with. And again, you're going to hear me go over and over to calling for a movement for an analog society in a lot of ways. And other people, are starting to sound the alarm about this. I'm not saying don't use technology, but don't rest on technology, right? We have to reclaim those analog spaces like newspapers, physical newspapers, right? Support them with money. We have to reclaim libraries. We have to reclaim bookstores, physical bookstores. We have to reclaim town halls, churches and synagogues and mosques, right? Safely, great ventilation, masks, social distancing. If we lose these spaces, we are going to be completely managed by a censored data stream. And now I will explain that, and then I'll take your questions. This section is called Digital Search is Always Already Political. The experience of bringing out outrages also highlights how digital search itself is political in a way that has huge implications for scholarship and the academy. But it also has huge implications for social policy, for law enforcement, for social accountability and transparency, for the very sense of who matters in a society. The proceedings of the Old Bailey, which the initial host, who was much reproduced but who made mistakes in his summary, drew on to support his argument that homosexuals were not seriously persecuted in Victorian England, it's an amazing sight. It's also largely funded by the British government. The co-directors of the, and this is just an example I'm using to show you how digital search is shaping what you can see and understand and know. The co-directors of the Proceedings of the Old Bailey are very transparent about why users should not just rely on their database to understand what happened to prisoners tried in that London court. They point out that the proceedings are not actual court transcripts, right? They're not, again, the analog world. They're not the physical court transcripts that would be in a library, but they are rather sensationalized booklets that the government itself produced based on trials that were then distributed to news agents to sell. They are at least one remove from primary documents. But there are other reasons not just to rely on that database. When I asked them to search how many people were actually executed for sodomy in the 19th century in Britain, the co-directors got a result of 14 deaths. That was their search. Today, when you search, you're likely to get only 4 results of executions for sodomy in the 19th century. However, H.G. Cox of the University of Nottingham, author of Nameless Offences, consulted actual court and parliamentary transcripts and cross-referenced with news reports, and he found the actual 56 deaths from execution for sodomy and 8,000 committals for same-sex sexual offenses in the 19th century. So in that analog world, right, when Dr. H.G. Cox looked at real newspapers and matched them with real court transcripts, he found dozens of executions, but the digital guys didn't find them. Okay, so in the analog world, it's a very different and much darker picture of being what we would call gay in the 19th century than the Proceedings Digital Database funded by the British government offers. And Dr. Charles Upchurch also gets comparable very high numbers using a similar methodology, analog, right? Looking at the court records, looking at the newspapers. So how can this divergence be? And bear with me, this is going to get kind of nerdy, but you can follow it, and it is important. People do not understand what a database is and how vulnerable it is to altering or obscuring the versions of reality it yields. People think that when they search a digitized archive, or search Google for that matter, or search coronavirus, right, they are getting a transparent replication of what had been stacks in a library or newspaper articles, with all the results showing the way that they would show if you looked in a card catalog for an author or subject, or looked through newspapers, or walked down the aisles of a physical library. But that is not the case. It is not true. The way search is configured yields the picture of current events, of a virus, a picture of history that a student or scholar will find. In other words, search decides what you see and learn and know, and you will never know what is missing. The very narrow picture of persecution of gay men yielded by a search for this subject in the Proceedings of the Old Bailey were a result simply of, I'm going to teach you a phrase, a narrow search term parameter. Some of you may know what this means, others may not. It's not too hard for you to understand. It means that the developers tag certain words to make sure that results are yielded that relate to those terms, right? That happens on what's called the back end. So you don't see it. What you see are the results on what's called the front end, right? When you search for something. So the search terms employed by the machine of the Proceedings of the Old Bailey funded by the British government are only two for sodomitical offenses, according to Dr. Robert Shoemaker, co-director of the platform. But, ha-ha, there weren't just two terms for same-sex offenses. There were eight or nine terms, as Dr. Cox points out, in use legally at this time for sodomitical or same-sex sexual offenses. Sodomy, buggery, indecent offense, indecent assault, even for consenting sex acts, as I mentioned, and many, many others. But only an historian working closely in this narrow field would know that, right? So again, if you know there are eight search terms, you're going to recognize 56 deaths, thousands of committals. If you use only two search terms, you get much smaller results. But the digitization of archives means a new intervention, whether inadvertent or intentional, is now possible in the pictures that students get of history or moving it up to the present moment of current events. Many archives are being digitized right now. When I started work on outrages, the Digital British Periodicals database was openly available, and now it's been put behind a private paywall. The Digital Panopticon, which has life outcomes for prisoners, now links to formerly public records that are behind a private paywall. Library after library is saving costs by moving from the expensive storage and costly curating of physical books to digitized databases or research materials. So, most of us think that's great. Libraries can save money. It's also convenient. I can search, sitting in my pajamas in my home. But there are dangers. There are dangers, and these directly affect you right now, sitting at home, reliant on digital space and digital information to know how to protect your family or to know what's true or what's not true about this epidemic or other current events, the election. many other issues. So there's now a two-tier class system around the quality of information developing. The ability to manipulate historical records and narratives is intensified because inadequate or misleading information sources are abundant and free, whereas solid sources are increasingly costly or behind a paywall. Everyone has access to the Daily Beast, the Huffington Post, Agence France-Presse, and other free news sites that reproduced the inaccurate story that dozens of men had not been executed for sodomy in the 19th century. Reporters themselves had free access to those erroneous stories. And the Proceedings of the Old Bailey, with its built-in problems identified by its co-directors, is free, and it comes up at the top of a Google search. BBC Radio is free. The government funds it. But the accurate sources that told the truth about the severe, deadly extent of persecution of men for same-sex love in the 19th century were hard to find, and you had to pay to get at them. Professor H.G. Cox's book is available online for about $30 a download. Same with Professor Upchurch's book. Professor Paul Johnson's article about how Parliament was debating the death penalty for sodomy into the 1840s is behind an academic paywall. Ordinary people can't get access to them. Even specialists can't easily get access to them. This field that locks up good information but makes bad information abundant and free makes it open season for campaigns, or even campaigns around public health, to sway public opinion with distorted data or scholarship, to distort history in ways that we've seen in the recent past. And, political campaigns themselves can be distorted and swayed. So scholarship itself is at risk, even in the universities. There are many reasons to clean up or excise or whitewash records if you're a government or a private company. When you simply alter search terms or limit search terms, like they're critics of the lockdown, and they're harder to find. Google makes them harder to find, right? Twitter will make them harder to find. YouTube will make them harder to find. When you simply alter search terms or dial down access to alternative points of view, you don't need to burn down the monasteries or pass censorship laws in democracies, excuse me, or pass laws forbidding the participation in culture that this very country knows so well from its own history. You don't even have to, like, pretend to do away with the First Amendment. With just a few strokes altering a computer code, a thread of historical narrative can vanish, or whole subsets of victims, or embarrassing statistics, or crises, or atrocities, or crimes, or critics of public health policy can vanish. And there is no record of the excision. It's not like seeing the rubble of a burned-down Renaissance library, or pages cut out of a book, or books locked away in a sealed cabinet. You would search the excise database or search Google or search YouTube and never know what's missing. If you combine the fingerprintless digital excision of strands of history via search setting with a barrage of viral and AI-driven counter-narratives on social media that make assertions to the contrary, well, this is our new publishing and scholarly environment, our new environment in which we're learning about public health issues, in which we're being told to lock down, give up our livelihoods, give up our children's right to go to school. Those might be the right decisions for your family, they might not, but you are not getting all the information. But with the digitization and privatization of records on which history is based, and search results censoring alternative views on current events, on public health, we are all vulnerable to threads in the fabric of history, or in the totality of current events being pulled by digital hands that are not visible to us. We have to understand these disorienting new capabilities of search eliding data and AI misrepresenting narratives and erasing public health information, critics of data, critics of the directions our societies are going, if we are to gain hold again of real scholarship, real journalism, real libraries, real medicine, real medical data, and make sure the universities are robust guardians of actual documentation to make sure that we all have access to what is actually true and to a whole range of opinions. So that is my presentation for you tonight. Let's see what questions we have. This Reggie Sylvester says this stuff was done in American slavery. They owned our bodies. Reggie, you are absolutely right. And that's a much deeper and more important and longer conversations when we should have at another time soon, because I think that the trauma of having one's body owned or managed by the state lasts for generations. I think the trauma of, queer people's bodies being managed by the state lasts for generations. It was traumatic for women to be kidnapped, basically, with the Contagious Diseases Acts and vaginal exams forced on them. But that's nothing compared to the trauma of 400 years of bodies being owned, tortured, managed by the state, children being sold away. I mean, I just read Bury the Chains, which is Adam Hochschild's book on slavery, and the version of slavery we're given in school is absolutely nothing. It's such a good example of the whitewashing of history to the kind of 400-year-long, global machine of torture that slavery really was. Torture, murder, rape. And I think these things stay with us. They don't go away just because, it's all 2020 now. We have to pay attention to what happens when the state manages people's bodies. Let's see. David Figueroa says the fear, joblessness, and elderly being stripped away from their loved ones is weakening immune systems much more than COVID-19 ever could, especially the lack of vitamin D. It's maddening. So David Figueroa, thank you. I am not a doctor. I'm a literary doctor. But many physicians are starting to talk about that or have been for a while. If there was really a holistic public health concern, the depression and alcoholism, I mean, people are dying of loneliness. People need touch, people need sunshine. These all support immune systems. So fresh air also. So it does seem bizarre to me, again, I'm not a doctor, that so much public health policy around COVID, and I'm not, making a statement epidemiologically, but looking at it as a political consultant, it's almost like these public health policies are designed to make populations give up, like psychologically. And that's why I'm very intrigued by my husband's analysis that, we're under attack basically by a foreign country that wishes us ill. Because really, how would you, when you're a political consultant, you learn to read events backwards, meaning you look at the outcome and then you go back to see how did they get this outcome. And because you know that the story that's told about why something is happening almost never matches the desired outcome. In other words, usually you start with an outcome like, let's invade Afghanistan. And then you have to find a story like, because girls aren't allowed to go to school in Afghanistan, that people will buy. So because I know that as a former political consultant, I'm looking at the effects of coronavirus policy, and the effects are, let's break these populations. Let's break human connection. Let's make sure people cannot gather and assemble to push back against anything. Let's create a centrally planned economy, which is the dream of billionaires because they can short or long the economy, without going to jail and make billions and billions as Jeff Bezos and Bloomberg and Bill Gates and others have done since the pandemic started. And if you really cared about people's health, you would not separate them and punish them for being voluntarily close to each other. I often think about the HIV pandemic, and then I'll go back to the questions. But I'm old enough to remember the HIV epidemic. It was and is a terrible epidemic. And early on, evil people were saying, let's separate these people. Let's have the state take possession of their bodies if they're HIV positive. Let's forbid them to have intercourse, with anyone. Let's put them in jail if they try to have sex with people. Let's contact trace their lovers against their will and violate their medical privacy and quarantine them away from society and not let them circulate, with human beings. And there was a huge outcry, rightly, against that very evil approach. And the community led the response to the epidemic. The community mobilized to persuade people to act responsibly in making sure they weren't transmitting the virus sexually. The community lobbied for the right kind of health care and support for people who were HIV positive. The community took care of making sure that, people got the resources they needed. And it was a horrible epidemic. Thousands of people died, but no one lost their civil liberties. And so the difference now, many of you know that I did a video and I wrote an essay showing that there's never been a lockdown of this kind in any quarantine historically ever, including airborne infectious diseases. So it's completely unprecedented, and it does not have to be this way in a terrible epidemic as the HIV epidemic showed. Let's see, Lenny Smith says, "Hi Naomi, interesting point about a power grab over people's bodies. Unfortunately, a perverse twist of that phenomenon seems to come into play with the equation of mask wearing with reduction of civil liberties, which people are carrying to an extreme that implies that the social contract doesn't include a responsibility not to infect one another in a pandemic." So Lenny, I do agree with you, but again, thinking about the response to HIV from the community of people who included those who are HIV positive, I think the social contract does include not infecting people with HIV or not infecting people with coronavirus. But the state didn't, lock people down when they were infected. They were encouraged to voluntarily change their behavior. And, it's not the social contract that I'm challenging. It's the state mandating. And this is a big difference. We should be respectful of each other. We should be careful. We should be taking care. I wear a mask, right? But when the state says this is what you have to do, and in America, we're not even seeing the most extreme manifestation of this. People are getting fined for taking their masks off when they're alone outdoors on a path in Australia. Right? In Ireland, people are being forbidden from having visitors, right? We're not seeing this. I only know because people tell me. It's not a matter of global news coverage. This is the state invading our most personal decisions. And so I'm a big believer in the social contract, but it doesn't always have to be mediated through police and state legal mandates. Kelly Mercer, hi Kelly, thank you always for your support for this community. People do not know that we no longer live in a democracy. People are being managed, focusing on debate, solve nothing, more energy to rumors and everybody engaged. So many calculated distractions, successful to tyrants. Kelly, I agree with you. There are a ton of distractions right now. And again, as a political consultant, distractions are there when someone's stealing all the stuff. Or locking you down and stripping you of your liberties. And what you're seeing, and I'll say it over and over for people who have not been part of other videos, we're seeing in Australia, we're seeing in Britain, we're seeing in Canada, we're seeing in the United States, the stripping away of parliamentary processes, the stripping away of freedoms, the stripping away of freedoms to assemble in the United States, the stripping away of parliamentary traditions. The bypassing of Parliament in Australia. So Lenny Smith says, tell that to the 220,000 dead Americans and the loved ones mourning them. So again, I very much mourn the dead Americans, just like I mourn the thousands and tens of thousands dead from HIV. But free societies don't lock down their citizens. It's that simple. Police states do. And I know that this is a hard thing to hear, but for years and years we were told the only thing that matters is terrorism. and you should give up your liberties for any reason if it can save one life from terrorism. And now we're being told that the only thing that matters is coronavirus. And I can tell you, as a student of history, it is a terrible thing that 220,000 people are dead. And it's a terrible thing that thousands of people died from HIV, or that thousands of people died from the Spanish flu, or from tuberculosis, or were paralyzed by polio. But there is something even worse than thousands dead, and that is a police state. That is even worse, because in a police state, they can murder whoever they want. They can, starve the population to death. They can turn them into slaves. They can keep your children enslaved and your grandchildren for, centuries into the future. And that is actually worse. So we need to broaden our consciousness, because we're being asked to think it's either no deaths or you are evil, right? But there's a bigger space in which there are risks and sacrifices in a free society. You could have locked up every single person who is HIV positive, and you would have saved lives. But that's not what we do in America, right? And again, I'll post my essay. It's on drnaomiwolf.com. There has never in history, in a free society, been a lockdown. Even in the worst epidemics, and there have been quarantines of sick people. There have been quarantines of the sick, right? But never, and there have been like neighborhoods locked down when there was plague. There's never been an insistence that the entire society locked down, shelter in place, all these horrible cliches for being prisoners. That has never happened. So where does that happen? In North Korea, it happens. In closed societies, it happens. Laura Thorpe said physical libraries are so important. Absolutely. El Canel said the New York Times lied us into Iraq, wants me to subscribe. Very true. You guys, I should wrap it up soon. The New York Times has a COVID data map every day. You cannot see the data sets underlying that map. I've been tweeting to the reporter who covers COVID. I've been asking her to show me the data sets. I know how to look at them. I run a data company. No one is showing you the data sets, right? Journalists are claiming and reiterating claims from Johns Hopkins, from the COVID Tracking Project, from USAFacts.com about COVID. New York Times is too. But when you click through, and I'm encouraging you to do this, try to find the data sets, the raw data. There's no reason not to link to them. The sources and the methodology. And that means, where do these infections come from? Where do these numbers come from? And how are they identified? What's the definition of a case, right? In Oregon, the definition of a case was, do you have cough or fever, right? It wasn't a test. It wasn't checking into a clinic. It wasn't checking into a hospital. It wasn't a doctor's report. So the numbers fall apart when you look at them, and we all need to become kind of data literate, and I will help you with that. But click through to these maps and ask questions on social media, ask questions of the New York Times. Where are the data sets? How do you know, right? What proof do you have? Why can't we check? Pedro Figueroa says they not only want to own our bodies, now they're after our minds. I agree with you, Pedro. Kathy Cass says, it's been more than 20 years since federal funding was withheld from community libraries, unless the library board granted the federal government access to their databases of people's records. Kathy, I did not know that. That is extraordinarily terrifying. Thomas Salon says, thank you, Naomi. I found this absolutely riveting. One of the most provocative presentations I've seen all year. Thank you. So I'm going to respond to that very humbly, and then I should go because my dog needs to go outside. But I should respond very humbly by saying there is a war on independent publishers, independent thought leaders, independent influencers like me, and like my book, and like many influencers out there. And we really need your help. So please support my publisher, Chelsea Green, by ordering a copy of Outrages. Please do and read it. It's really important. This book was nearly killed once. It has survived. It's on bestseller lists for categories like British law, but I need you to do me a great favor if you find my work valuable and order it, because that is the only way that independent publishers like Chelsea Green will survive. And independent voices too really need readers' support. And the other thing is, please go to drnaomiwolf.com, join Daily Clout, where we bring you legislation and explanations of legislation, current events, things like this. And I will just keep reporting and sharing. I'll share the second two halves of this essay with you tomorrow night, if we can. I'll try to do it at the same time. I'll let you know. And this is it for me. Gosh, it's 55 minutes. There are a lot of great questions, and we will pick them up again. Oh, that's so interesting. Naomi, medical error is the third leading cause of death. That is fascinating. That's pretty serious. Okay, I want to read one last thing. Christina Lundberg says, "You're absolutely right about the censorship by Google et al. Mainstream media. I've been a freelance journalist most of my life, and when my gut feeling tells me some narrative isn't correct, I look up grassroots et al. Like the Syrian conflict." So there's another independent journalist confirming what I'm saying. All right, I love you guys. I'm grateful. Be safe. Be well. Keep thinking critically. Keep asking questions, and join me here tomorrow night, let's say 10 o'clock Eastern time, for the second half of this essay. And the book is Outrages: Sex, Censorship, and the Criminalization of Love. Take care. Good night.